You're standing there in the doorway, looking at that old tired carpet, or maybe the stained linoleum, and you're wondering if you can really transform this space yourself.
I've been right where you are, staring at a stack of boxes and a tapping block, feeling that mix of excitement and the slight weight of a project that feels bigger than it actually is.
The truth about a floating floor, whether it's a high-end laminate or a heavy-duty luxury vinyl plank, is that the magic isn't in the clicking of the boards. The magic is in the patience you show before you even open the first box.
It's a mechanical puzzle that relies on physics and a bit of foresight.
And if we walk through this together, you're gonna end up with a floor that doesn't just look like a professional did it, but one that feels solid under your boots for the next 20 years.
Before we even think about the first row, we have to talk about what's happening underneath your feet. A floating floor is exactly what the name implies. It isn't glued down, it isn't nailed, and it isn't stapled to the subfloor.
It's an independent island of material, held together by its own weight and the interlocking tongues and grooves of the planks. Because of that, the floor is going to move.
It's going to expand when the humidity climbs in the summer, and it's going to shrink just a hair when the furnace kicks on in the winter.
If we don't give it the room to do that, the floor will protest.
It'll buckle, or the joints will start to pull apart, and that's a headache we're going to avoid by respecting the expansion gap.
I learned the hard way about what happens when you don't respect the prep work. Years ago, I was rushing to finish a kitchen for a friend before a big party.
I looked at the subfloor and saw a slight dip near the refrigerator, maybe a quarter of an inch deep over a 3-foot span. I figured the underlayment would hide it, and the planks were stiff enough to bridge the gap. I finished the floor, it looked beautiful, and I felt like a hero.
2 weeks later, every time someone walked toward the fridge, there was this hollow, rhythmic thud. Then, the clicking joints started to crack, because they were being flexed down into that dip every single day.
I had to pull up half the floor, level the subfloor with a self-leveling compound, and start over.
It was a humbling lesson.
Now, I don't move a single plank until I've run a long straight edge across the room to make sure the subfloor is flat within an eighth of an inch over 10 feet.
If there's a hill, we sand it down. If there's a valley, we fill it.
Once the floor is flat, we need to think about the environment. Those boxes of flooring have been sitting in a warehouse or on a cold truck.
If you bring them inside and start installing them immediately, they're going to change shape as they reach room temperature.
I always bring the flooring into the room where it's going to be installed, at least 48 hours before I start.
Stack the boxes flat, not on their ends, and crisscross them so air can circulate.
While that flooring is acclimating, we're going to get the room ready.
We aren't just cleaning, we're obsessing.
Every grain of sand or stray staple left on that subfloor is a potential clicking sound or a bump that will haunt you later.
I like to vacuum the floor, then go over it with a damp microfiber mop to get the fine dust.
When you run your hand across the subfloor, it should feel like a clean countertop.
Now we look at the door casings. This is where a lot of people get intimidated, but it's actually one of the most satisfying parts of the job.
You don't want to try and cut the flooring to fit around the complex shapes of a door frame.
Instead, we're going to cut the frame to fit the flooring.
I take a scrap piece of the new plank and a piece of the underlayment we're using, lay them upside down against the casing, and use a flat pull saw to cut through the wood trim.
By using the flooring as a guide, the saw creates a perfect slot at the exact height we need.
We slide the new floor right under the trim, and suddenly it looks like the house was built around the floor.
If your flooring doesn't have the padding already attached to the back, we're going to roll out our underlayment now.
This stuff is more than just a cushion.
It acts as a moisture barrier and a sound dampener.
We lay it out in long strips, making sure the edges don't overlap.
Overlapping creates a ridge
that will telegraph through the floor. We butt the edges together and seal them with the tape provided by the manufacturer. As we walk on it, you'll notice the room starts to sound quieter already. When we're ready to lay the first plank, we have to look at the room as a whole. No room is perfectly square, and if we just start on one wall and go, we might end up with a tiny sliver-thin piece of flooring on the opposite side that looks terrible and won't stay locked in. I measure the width of the room and divide by the width of a plank. If that math tells me the last row is going to be less than 2 inches wide, I'll actually rip down the first row of planks a bit to balance the room out. It's a little extra work up front, but the symmetry is worth it. We start in a corner, usually working left to right. We place spacers against the wall to maintain that quarter-inch expansion gap I mentioned earlier. These spacers are our insurance policy. Without them, the floor will eventually push against the drywall and start to peek at the seams. We lay the first plank with the tongue side facing the wall. The second plank clicks into the short end of the first. You'll feel it drop into place. Some floors require a gentle tap with a rubber mallet and a tapping block to fully seat the joint. You're listening for a solid thud. A hollow click means the joint isn't fully engaged. When we get to the end of the first row, we're going to have to cut a plank to fit. I turn the plank around, mark it where it meets the wall, remembering to account for that expansion gap, and use a miter saw or a floor cutter to make a clean, square cut. The leftover piece from that cut, provided it's at least a foot long, becomes the first piece of our second row. This creates a staggered pattern. You never want your end joints to line up like a grid. It looks unnatural, and it's structurally weaker. We want those joints to be at least 6 to 8 inches apart from the row next to it. The second row is where the rhythm starts. We angle the long side of the plank into the groove of the first row at about a 30-degree angle. As we lower it, you'll feel the tongue slide home. If it doesn't drop easily, don't force it. Sometimes a little bit of debris gets into the groove, or the previous plank is slightly out of alignment. We keep moving, row by row, checking our progress. Every few rows, I like to stand back and look down the seams. They should be perfectly straight, like a set of railroad tracks. If you see a gap opening up, stop immediately. Use your tapping block to close it up before you move on. If you ignore a small gap in row 3, it will be a canyon by row 10. Working around floor vents or radiator pipes requires a bit of patience. For a pipe, I'll measure its position, drill a hole in the plank that's slightly larger than the pipe, and then make a straight cut from the hole to the edge of the plank. We slide the plank into place, then glue the small piece back in behind the pipe. It's a clean look that still allows the floor to move. For floor vents, we just cut the opening in the plank with a jigsaw, making sure the vent cover is wide enough to hide the expansion gap around the hole. As we reach the final row, things get a little tighter. We usually have to rip these planks lengthwise to fit the remaining space. This is where a pull bar becomes your best friend. Since there's no room to use a tapping block against the wall, we hook the pull bar over the edge of the plank and tap the other end of the bar with a hammer. This pulls the final row snugly into the rest of the floor. You'll feel the whole floor tighten up as that last row goes in. It's a great feeling, like the last piece of a puzzle clicking home. Now we pull out all those spacers. The floor is officially floating. But we aren't done until we cover those expansion gaps. We install our baseboards or shoe molding, but here is the critical rule. We nail the molding to the wall, never to the floor. If you nail through the flooring, you've just turned your floating floor into a fixed floor, and all that work we did to allow for expansion is gone. By nailing to the wall, the floor is free to slide back and forth underneath the trim as the seasons change. As you walk across your new floor for the first time, take off your shoes. Feel the way the surface is uniform and solid. Listen for the lack of squeaks. There's a specific kind of pride that comes with looking at a floor and knowing that every single joint is tight because you took the time to do it right. You've changed the entire character of your home with your own hands. It wasn't about the tools or the expensive materials. It was about the preparation, the patience, and the way you respected the movement of the wood. You've got a floor now that will stand up to the dogs, the kids, and the years. And every time you walk on it, you'll remember the day you decided you were the right person for the job. Now that the main floor is down and the trim is back in place, you might be looking at where the new floor meets the carpet in the hallway or the tile in the bathroom. Would you like me to walk you through how to install transition strips and T-moldings to bridge those different surfaces?